At the end of the forum this afternoon, let me ask that everyone, regardless of where in the building you may be seated, if you would stay in your seats to permit the senator and his party to exit the building. We've got some complicated logistics, and we'd like to make it easy for the senator and his party to leave. So if everyone would just stay where they are, that would be very much appreciated. Senator Edward Moore Kennedy is a graduate of Harvard University, and more importantly for our purposes, of the University of Virginia Law School. Senator Kennedy was elected to the Senate in 1962 to complete the unexpired term of his brother, John Fitzgerald Kennedy, who had been elected president in 1960. Since then, he's been reelected to 7 full terms and is now the second most senior member of the Senate. In the Senate, Kennedy has been active on a wide range of issues: affordable and accessible quality health care for all Americans, education reform, immigration reform, raising the minimum wage, strengthening civil rights, protecting and strengthening Social Security and Medicare, clean air and clean water, among many other issues. He's published 2 books on public policy, and on April 16th, just a few weeks from now, Viking will publish his latest work, America Back on Track, in which he reveals his plan to revive the lapsed ideals of our nation. He is now the ranking member of the Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions Committee, and serves on the Armed Services Committee, the Joint Economic Committee, and the Judiciary Committee. Please welcome Senator Edward Kennedy.
Thank you. Thank you very much, George, for your extremely kind and generous introduction, and for all and for inviting me here today. And I want to thank you very much for all your good leadership here at the Miller Center Forum. And I want to say what an honor it is for my wife Vicki and I to join with you here today. Earlier today, we had a chance to speak over in the auditorium at the Kaplan Auditorium to the students, and I commented at that time of the 2-day conference that the students have organized down here on a variety of different issues involving public interest in the law, and looking at this in a variety of different ways. And when I was speaking to some of the young ones, students, they all said they had a remarkable attendance, which impressed me deeply, since this is the day after St. Patrick's Day. And we couldn't possibly have had that if it was up in Boston. I'll tell you just you're very lucky, because you're only going to hear one of my St. Patrick's Day jokes. And that was Sheriff Hennessy was the sheriff of Suffolk County, which is Boston. And he noticed that a trainer called Patrick had a series of winners at the Suffolk Downs racetrack. Matter of fact, had 5 straight winners on their big prize day, and the big race was going to be the 7th race. And so Sheriff Hennessy was up with his binoculars looking over the stables, and he looked down there and he saw trainer Patrick look all to the left, and then look to the right, then look up, and then look down, and then reach into his pocket and pull something out and look around again and give it to the favorite horse. So Sheriff came out, NSC came out of the stands, down he came, past all of the stables, and he came up to Trainer Patrick and said, "Trainer Patrick, you're gonna get arrested for tampering with this horse." And Trainer Patrick says, "What are you talking about?" "Well, I saw you reach in your pocket and give the horse something." He says, "It's nothing but a piece of sugar." He said, "Is that right?" "Yes," he said, "I take it all the time." And Trainer Patrick reached in and took out a little cube and popped it in his mouth. And he said, "Sheriff, would you like a piece?" And he said, "All right." So he gave it to him and he popped it in his mouth. And the sheriff goes back up to the stands. And it comes to the 9th race. And Trainer Patrick takes his horse and puts it to the very outside position. And he gives these instructions to the jockey: "As soon as the bell rings, stay on the outside, because nothing's going to pass you unless it's me or Sheriff Fitzpatrick." And Well, that gives you an idea of the kind of things that were going along. And save you from the others. It is wonderful to, I had a good opportunity to talk to some of those that are watching on the television here, and reminded them, went down just before coming in here this afternoon, and reminded them that I came from a large family. We had 9 members of our family, and whenever there was an overflow, it was always my sister Jean and I were always in the extra room during lunchtime, so I have a great empathy for those that may not be actually here, but we had a chance to go down, Vicki and I, to meet them and greet them and thank them for joining with us today. It is wonderful to be back in Charlottesville. As you all know, I attended the law school at UVA, and I saw its longstanding commitment to excellence every day. It is a tremendous living legacy to Thomas Jefferson and the many others who have kept it strong over the years. And I have many wonderful memories of my time in Charlottesville. I met a dear friend, John Tunney, here. We first met in the cafeteria and became inseparable for those 3 years, and great friends for almost 50 years since then. We worked hard, surprised even ourselves when we prevailed in the moot court competition. And I know that both of us cherish the time that we had here and the values we learned and the influences had on our lives. I have an immense respect for the Miller Center and Jim Young. As all of you know, Jim is a soft-spoken man with an extraordinary spirit and a commitment to excellence that has guided his academic career. He is the preeminent expert in oral history, and he has persuaded me that my oral history project would be perfect for the Miller Center. As always, he was right, and it's been a privilege to work with him at the center. Jim is a superb interviewer. He knows how to get right to the point, and I'm sure he'll create a vivid record of the public policy issues of our time. It'll be an enormous resource for scholars and researchers and all of us who love history, and I'm grateful for his diligence and his ability. I thank Steve Knott for his impressive research and guidance on the project. His work, too, is essential to the success of this important effort. And I'd like to recognize Gene Fife, who has demonstrated outstanding leadership as the director of the Miller Center for the Public Affairs. It's a privilege to be with 2 great governors who were good enough to be here today. And I thank them for their joining with us. Jerry was a successful governor and respected attorney, and his leadership and scholarship will serve the center very well. And it's a pleasure to be with his wife and be with Robin as well. In recent years, Americans have become increasingly aware of the importance of oral history as part of our national heritage. The written record, of course, is indispensable, and historians have long used it to capture basic moments and turning points in the struggles of the past, and to analyze the character and the influence of historic figures. This work has enabled scholars to explore the cause and effect of critical decisions that shape the country and the world, and encourage us to learn more about the personalities and intentions of those responsible for history's defining moments. Historical writing inspires critical thinking and encourages self-examination and teaches important skills for contemporary decision making. This was illustrated to me so clearly a number of years ago when my brother Bob wrote a book called The 13 Days on the Cuban Missile Crisis. And he asked me if I would ask Harold Macmillan, who had been the Prime Minister of England, to do the introduction for the book. And I went to London and went out to the country and visited with Harold Macmillan and about his willingness to do that. And at the end of the lunch, he brought me into a room where it had a number of file cabinets with different years on it. And he saw 1962, this is probably 1966, and he said October 1962, and he reached in and he pulled out about October 12th, which was the beginning of the Cuban Missile Crisis. And from October 12th for the 13 days, he had probably 25 handwritten pages on every one of those days, and his conversations with President Kennedy. And Harold Macmillan, as you probably know, was almost lost in the First World War. He's left for dead on the battlefields of Verdun. He's 17 years old and then came back and entered Parliament and had a brilliant career and was the Prime Minister during those period of time. And he, every day of his life, he wrote in his diary his decisions as the British Prime Minister, and of course are invaluable, but that is so exceptional. The interesting part of the Macmillan story is that he said after the 13 days, and he had written everything that had been stated by their conversations between President Kennedy and Harold Macmillan, and Harold Macmillan asked President Kennedy to send someone over to London to go through his record, to be able to take out anything that was particularly sensitive in terms of American national security. And he showed me on the last day the handwritten notes, and he said he had talked to President Kennedy. President Kennedy said, "Your security and our security are inevitably tied together, and you will understand what is in the security of the interests of both countries." And he said that was the formation of a relationship between two leaders of countries that continued during the time that both of them were leaders, and formed a bond which was obviously extraordinary in terms of our nations. But that kind of written history is not the case today. Oral history adds a new dimension to the historical record. It's not a new phenomenon, but in recent years it's emerged as an increasingly influential part of America's recorded legacy. Oral history enables historians to probe directly the motives, the fears, and vision of those who shape policy, make decisions, and affect the world around them. It broadens our access to history. It deepens our understanding of the people, decisions, and events that define our country and the world we live in. And the listener has the added benefit of the genuineness and spontaneity of the human voice. Oral history allows those who participate in history, rather than historians, to provide tone and shading to the words that describe their thoughts and their deeds. The Congress I've been so privileged to serve in was established after divisive debates and huge compromises. The basic issue was the appropriate balance of power for the newly independent and often quarrelsome colonies. The miracle in Philadelphia produced a remarkably resilient system of government that has withstood the massive transformations of over two centuries of our history. Today, we marvel at the enterprise and vision of the founders. Imagine if we could hear the voices of the founders today, hear their own account of their own deliberations and interactions, and of the hopes and fears that weighed on their minds during the birth of a nation. I've been honored to serve the people of Massachusetts in the Senate. Over the years, I've been fortunate to witness and participate in some of the great debates of our time, from critical decisions of war and peace to the battles for civil rights to expanding health care and improving education. It's been a tremendous privilege, and I look forward to many more years of service in this institution that I love so much. One way I hope to repay that privilege is to participate in this oral history project and provide future generations with a firsthand account of the legislative battles of my lifetime. The idea of an oral history first emerged from a dinner that my wife Vicki and I had with family members and friends a few years ago. We were discussing the vast history of the Senate and the many contentious issues of the present. And Arthur Schlesinger suggested that I create an oral history project to preserve the future generations, for future generations. Not just the facts of our contemporary history, but the flavor and the context as well. And after dinner, I asked my good friend Lee Fentress, another UVA law school graduate, to explore how we could preserve some of that history and make it available to the future. And Lee went to work on the project with his characteristic persistence and attention to detail, and his search led inevitably to Jim Young and the Miller Center. I've long believed that scholars and politicians, and private citizens as well, would benefit from a further examination of the Senate and what we do as senators. The essence of this project is that all points of view will be included. The advocates, the adversaries alike, to give the project the depth and integrity essential for future scholars. As UVA's own Thomas Jefferson once said, truth is the first object. It's essential for history to know the details of the nation's achievements and failures, its proudest moments and darkest hours. Integrity in that pursuit is vital because history lays the foundation for America's continuing ideals, the values of liberty, justice, equality, and civic responsibility. The strength of our democracy and the vitality of our nation depend on informed and active citizens and accurate knowledge of the times. We have succeeded or failed to live up to those ideals. I hope that the project will contribute, at least in small way, to the understanding of contemporary public policy. Although we strive to carry on the ideals of the founders, we are a different people than we were even a half century ago. It is important to know how public debate shaped that evolution, molded those changes, and ensured our prominent role in the global society. I, for one, will be enormously interested in looking back over this period of time at the dynamic of forces that have really altered and changed the general dialogue in terms of our country in dealing with the challenges that we are facing as a nation. My entrance really into the discussion and debate on public policy began with the Brown versus the Board of Education. I was in college at the time, but it was a matter of enormous importance and consequence. And it was something that changed the whole dialogue and debate in the country at that time. And I was enormously influenced by the fact that my brothers returned, two brothers who had been in the war, returned from World War II. And this was a generation that had assumed great responsibility and were prepared then to try and provide leadership for their country. And what we had then at that time are leaders, Republican and Democratic leaders, who were prepared to lead the nation. And we were able to deal with overwhelming challenges in foreign policy and in domestic policy. We dealt with the challenges of the Soviet Union and the Soviet and communist expansion. And we also went to work to rebuild our adversaries, to make them trading partners with Germany and Japan, and be able to see those countries develop democratic institutions. And so we worked together as a country, Republicans and Democrats, and we started also beginning to tame the dangers of nuclear proliferation, started by President Kennedy with the Non-Proliferation Treaty and continued all the way through with President Reagan. Democrats and Republicans providing vision in foreign policy and in domestic policy. And here at home, this nation faced the most difficult and challenging issue that we have ever faced, and that is the issue in terms of race. Our founding fathers missed it at the time of the Constitution and wrote slavery into the Constitution. We had a civil war. And then we had those decision, the courts, the Fifth Circuit, finally the Supreme Court, Brown versus Board of Education, and we had leaders who were prepared to challenge the nation and the country to knock down walls of discrimination and prejudice and bigotry. And I was on the floor of the United States Senate when we faced those first civil rights laws in 64, the 9 months or 10 months of a filibuster, and then eventually Republicans under the leadership of Everett Dirksen coming together, and we had the down payment on the 64 in public accommodations, 65 in the Voting Rights Act, 67 in terms of employment, 68 in terms of housing, and on and on and on. And not only did we sign that we knocked down the walls of discrimination on the race, we found out we knocked down walls of discrimination on gender, on discrimination against women in our society. And in the more recent times, we knocked down the walls of discrimination against the disability. 42 million Americans who somehow have some kind of a physical or mental kinds of challenges. And we said they are going to be a part of our American family. And at the same time, we committed this nation to move ahead on higher education and passed a higher education legislation. And we also said we're not going to let the poor in this nation, which are primarily the elderly people of this country, suffer in poverty. And we passed, I was there in 1964 when Medicare was defeated, in 1965 when it was passed, and the next year we passed Medicaid. Both of them passed within 8 months and implemented within 11 months without computers. And done so effectively with an administrative cost of only 2%. Now I ask myself, this was what we had at the time. This was a nation that was challenged in terms of its vision, both in foreign policy and in domestic policy. There may have been, through those periods of times, differences in how Republicans and how Democrats approach those kinds of issues, given the particular time. But anyone will have to look back at this period of time and said there were serious men and women of leadership in government that challenged the American people, and the American people responded, and we became a fairer and more just nation. And now I look at the time, and I am in the United States Senate, and wonder whether we are going to have a time like that in terms of the future. And that is something we have to, as a people and as a nation, whether we are going to find our time has passed. Are we going to say that China, that is producing 760,000 engineers this year, and India, that's 350,000 engineers, the Chinese budget is 20% in terms of research, and we are cutting back all our basic research in this nation. We are graduating 72,000 engineers in this nation, and half of them are foreign. Are we going to say that as we are looking at this new kind of challenge, as we looked at global, as we looked at the Soviet Union and the challenge of Soviet communism at that time, and as we looked at them inside ourselves and said that we haven't met the real challenges of the Declaration of Independence and the full dreams of the Constitution, and we are going to do it. Are we, as a country, going to be prepared to say, now we're facing a different challenge, and will our political institutions, will our political leaders stand up, and are we prepared to record the beginnings of those debates and those discussions so that future generations will know how America is going to be able to deal with its greatest challenges for the future. Oral history will be there during this period of time. The Miller Center will be there in this time, and future researchers, historians, for years to come, will forever take their hat off to the Miller Center here in Charlottesville at the University of Virginia for the contribution that this has made to our history, to our democracy, and to our nation being a better country. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator. During the time that Linwood Holton, who is with us today, was governor, the original gift to establish the Miller Center was received by the university, and shortly thereafter, Governor Holton became chairman of the governing council of the Miller Center. One of the early things they did was to hire Ken Thompson as actually the second director of the Miller Center. Professor Thompson took emeritus status several years ago, but has returned here today. As a political scientist, he studied matters of leadership, and I'd like to call on him to ask the first question. Ken?
Senator, how does one serve as a leader in CERT Senate when he or she is not in the majority?
Well, it's a good question. I want to recognize Mort Kaplan, too, who's a loyal son of the university and the law school, an enormous benefactor. You know, first of all, the question is, do you have the executive with you? If you have the executive with you, there are real opportunities to do it because you can work through that. They'll develop the program. And you have, even if I have found, you can put through various coalitions and have achievement. I found that during the president, when we had President Clinton, we had still Republicans, House and Senate. Give you an example, what they call the S-CHIP program, which is the health insurance program for children. That was a program that was in Massachusetts, and basically it took the idea, talked to Orrin Hatch, who happened to be interested in children, and we worked out a compromise. I said, if we're going to get recovery to the federal government from the tobacco industry, why don't we devote it towards the children's health? For children, from families up to 200% of poverty, which is probably, you know, $35,000 for a family of three. And so Orrin said, well, we won't do the Medicaid program, which is a superb program for children because it has a preventive care program, examinations for children, the well baby, and also helps the mothers, provides prenatal care for the mothers. But he said, well, let the state. Well, he said, I'm not going to take a federal program. That's what you like. We'll take, but I will support if we can let the states divide it. So we said, all right, well, they'll have to meet certain criteria and standards, and we worked those out, which incorporated the basic kinds of standards that had been in the Medicaid program, but he wanted to have the states make those judgments and decisions. And that bill has passed, and we've got probably 7 million children that are being covered because President Clinton got into it, but Hatch got into it, and we had, once you had that, you had a head of steam that you could be successful in the Senate and also in the House. It's a lot more difficult with, I must say, with the when you don't have any of the three. I'll mention one little small bill that probably no one's ever heard of, but it except 500,000 people, Americans, and that is what we call the Family Opportunities Act, which is Senator Grassley and my legislation in the Senate. And Pete Sessions, who's considered from Dallas and considered the most conservative member. This is the legislation that today, if families have the severely disabled children, the only way they can get the range of services is if they're under Medicaid. And to get it under Medicaid, they have to earn at the Medicaid level. And those very low salaries, as you can well imagine in the states, virtually in every state, even including in Massachusetts. It's a very low value. Now, many of these families also have two or three children, but the mother still has to work at the Medicaid level in order to get the services. And you'll find out that of the 500,000 of the most severely disabled children, the heads of the family end up being women. It's about 92% or 93% are the ones that effectively take care. I mean, it's not surprising to many of us. It is surprising to some people in Washington, but it's not surprising to, I think, everyone in this room. Now, what we did is permit them to buy into the Medicaid so that they, if they earned a little more, they could still get the services, but they contribute no more than 5% of their income. But so it was restricted what they'd have to pay in, they could get the range of different services. And that passed with Senator Grassley. That was in the bill. You didn't read about it, didn't hear about it. It's just underneath the surface. But I will tell you, for 500,000 of people now will be able to earn more, and it's going to be capped at the 5%. And you know why it goes out as a cost today? Because in the federal budget, we don't consider money paid in taxes as being offsetting some spending. So this is an expenditure considered because they're going to provide the services, even though they'll be providing most of the services in any event. And even though all of us know if the people have a higher salary, they're going to pay in taxes. And if you looked at it, at the balance of it, you'll find out that this effectively offsets each other because these people pay in more. They're going to get the services in any event. But I mean, I'm coming at from a point of view of someone who primarily works in education, in health, and in terms of the employment, and also in civil rights.
Senator Kathy Parker has been very active in our community in matters of women's rights, and I think she has a question.
To immigration reform.
Okay.
I would really appreciate hearing what your current deliberations are yielding in terms of immigration reform, and particularly I'm interested in hearing more about the guest worker proposition.
Good. Just very quickly, the current structure is completely broken. The current structure in terms of controlling our borders, particularly in the South as well as in the North, are completely broken today. And we have, in the last 4 years, put $10 billion more into border guards down in the South. And we have built, extended a fence down there. You have 1,800 miles of border with Mexico, and we have 4,200 miles in Canada. We've extended the fence. It's now 60 miles, and we've got more problems than we've ever had before. And we have probably 450 minimum, 1,000 people that are coming in to this country. This is a national security issue. This is a national security issue. And we have well-trained border guards that are spending their days chasing after gardeners across the desert down there in southern Texas and in Mexico. This system is broken, and it isn't going to work solely, I don't believe, and the facts demonstrate, solely by law enforcement alone. But there should be a very strong law enforcement component to it. That's number one. That's number one. Now, a second issue is, what are we going to do with the 12 million undocumented that are here at the present time? Let me stand up, please. 12 million undocumented that are here at the present time. This is the way I look at them. There are those in our Judiciary Committee said that they're criminals. They've broken the law, they've extended their, they're criminals. And we have to look at it this way. Or you can look at it this way. What are the qualities that we basically admire the most in people? Hard work, hard work. People devoted to their families, devoted to their families. People that have a faith, a belief, and a religion that care about the things that they believe in. You have those qualities in the people that are coming here. They're leaving behind members of their family. They repatriate about $17 billion a year back to their families, back into the other, in Mexico, mostly in Central America, some in other parts. And they're drawn here by who? Employers. Who contributing to this? This isn't just this crowd coming in here, breaking our laws. Just, we've got people out here saying, come in, come in, come in, I need you. We can't have an agribusiness in California unless we have 400,000 of you come in every year. I need you. I'm going to find out, drawing them in here, and people that are desperate on this. And they do come in, and they've been settled here. They haven't been able to get back. And I hold no brief for any of them if they have violated the law. But if they have not violated the law, if they paid their taxes, if they're workers, if they're learning English, we've got 60,000 green card workers that are in the armed forces today that are in Iraq and Afghanistan, and we've had scores of them that have been killed. So they are voluntary for the service at perhaps the highest rate of any particular group in our country. So we have, do we want to deport them? That'll cost you $240 billion just to move them out, let alone what it's going to mean in terms of our agribusiness to get them out there. That's implausible. What are you going to do with people that are married, they have children that are American citizens, or they have married American citizens? How are we going to divide these families up? And, quite frankly, they are essential into many, many different industries. That's certainly what the Chamber says, who's supporting our bill. So McCain and myself believe that you don't advance any of these ahead of anybody that has been waiting in line and can come into that. You say to them, look, you're going to have to continue your work here, and you can't get on the path for citizenship until everybody that has been waiting to line, which will take 6 years, is able to come in here under the immigration laws. And at that time, after the last one comes on in here, then you can start. If you've shown that you've kept your job, you've stayed out of trouble, then you can begin to earn American citizenship at that time. Now, that's the debate. Some will say that that's amnesty. I mean, and amnesty, as our governors would say, this is a hot political kind of a issue, and it gets royals people up. And no one's going to the head of the line. No one's going to, they're going to have to pay a penalty, a financial penalty, $1,000 when they get it, $1,000 when they adjust their status. And that is basically what we are attempting to do, and then to organize in a legal way temporary workers, so that those are the three elements of that. We are going to be marking this. I would have thought of Wednesday. I'm on the committee. I'm obviously a co-sponsor with Senator McCain. And we had at the last week and Wednesday, I didn't think it was going to go anyplace. And by Thursday, it looked like it would. And this is why it's interesting to get an oral history. What happened between Wednesday, noontime, and Thursday? Bill Frist said he's going to put his bill in. That was the switch. And with that switch, Specter said, well, he's not going to get his bill in before I get mine in. So what do you need, Kennedy? Not completely, but he's at least doing a smile and saying, can't we talk about it? And we are. And that is the kind of thing where if this eventually goes and works, and we eventually end up, I think, with two-thirds of the Senate on our side, Democrats, and if we get half the Republicans, I think we can go to the president, who has been courageous on this issue. We have an important area of difference, but he's been willing to talk about this when no one else has, and I think it's taken political heat for it. And we could go to him and say, look, can't we try and work out something on this? And I think this is an issue that isn't going to go away. It's only going to get worse, and he has a feeling, understanding, coming from a border state. And my dream is that maybe we get this passed. Just a final point. I know it's been a long answer. We have to work with Mexico, too. We're the only ones that want to try and work with Mexico. You have to get Mexico to cooperate with us in terms of the flow of people coming in. If you don't get them working with us, we can't do anything. And ours is the only bill that does that. And the Mexican government, all the political parties, they have an election coming up now. They've all signed a document. The candidates have, their principal representatives in the parliament, that they will work with us if we get our particular solution. And what we have to do is find ways where we can make it more appealing for people to remain in those areas and to get the cooperation of the government. Those have to be the elements that are included. I'm sorry, it's a longer answer than you. And yes, sir. I'll take maybe just a couple more. Okay.
Senator, yep. Mr. Jim Stoltz has a question.
After 43 years of distinguished service in the United States Senate, what do you consider your most important achievement?
My children. serious about it, but those are the best. I think it's basically it's what I consider sort of the kind of a march to progress that I've seen. I've outlined in general terms in my talk that the country has moved into a fairer country over this period of time. I don't. A lot of other people have been very important in that progress, but we've had an opportunity to play a role in some of these areas, particularly in education, particularly in health, in the areas of civil rights and overseas a bit as well. And I think I think all of us as the governors would understand that we're all standing on tall shoulders in all of these areas. And I'm still hope that somehow we can get to a healthcare system that's going to work for all Americans.
Senator, since the for the last several administrations, the joke in Washington has been, regardless of who wins the White House, David Gergen will be there. I think it's altogether appropriate that to ask the final question this afternoon, I call on the sister-in-law of David Gergen, Mrs. Jacqueline Gergen.
We're everywhere.
We're everywhere. Good for you.
Senator, what does the Democratic Party have to do to win the next election?
There you go. Let me just give it to you. I think it's security. It's security at home. It's homeland security. I think people are concerned about their pension security, their health security, education security, job security, security in their communities. I think themes on that issue, and then a sense of hope. My sense is that, from Jefferson to our great presidents, they have always been looking to the future. That's what our country has done. President Reagan, Morning in America. That's what Americans hope for. That's what they want. They want someone that's going to look to the future and be futuristic. So I think that those are the, you can spell it out in ways that, suit you. But I think people are looking. They want strong national security and national defense. They want home taken care. And I think in these other basic areas, which most families care about, there's a lot of anxiety. There certainly is in the areas of pensions. You know, the worried about Social Security and the pensions are gone, savings are down, what's going to happen, and where am I going to come out? We're involved in that pension conference now. There's a lot of anxiety in many of these areas of people that have, you know, played hard, played by the rules. And so I think it's there, plus a sense of hope about the future, that this country really is very special. We've got a very special role to play for our people and as an example for people around the world. I think that's where Jefferson thought it was good enough for him. It's good enough for all of us. Thanks very, very much.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you very, very much. Thanks an awful lot. It's good to have you. Nice to have you.